To express how honored I am to be invited onto your show for the first time. You featured so many amazing poets. I'm so honored to be here.
Mm-hmm.
The first poem I have for you is the first poem in my chapbook, Zipless. This poem is named Red Shoes. Fitting to buy my first Valentino shoes on Valentine's Day, 2,000 miles from home, by Newport Beach's flaming orange sunset. As one stage in my fertility journey ends, today the 10th and final time ova are surgically plucked from my body without anesthetic at this California New Age last-ditch clinic. I don't plan to care about ovulation again, no matter how this motherhood story ends. And Mama needs a new pair of shoes to commemorate this day. Shiny red 4-inch stilettos, trimmed with spiky gold pyramid studs for several days take-home pay, which is insane. But one pair of shoes is more than I've ever had to show for all I've spent on fertility drugs. Girls' night out with new dance class friends, all unencumbered by motherhood. I walk 5 minutes in sleek maroon dress, red heels, binge on high-end steak, cocktails, at sparkling Yale Town Blut, before we hop to next night's spot. Watch friends send off men who try to dance with us. As the girls pass around coveted cigarette on bus stop bench, they stare down at my feet. Cat, I can't believe you wore those shoes all night, they gasp. I swear I'm fine, I insist. Though big toenail throbs for weeks before falling off. Still hurts less than if I'd stayed in touch with old friends who became soccer moms and left me behind. Stumble home from my birthday dinner. Last selfie of red shoes tapping off red skin-tight dress. Bright stiletto now missing rubber tip, only raw metal left. For I'd felt my stiletto catch between the cobblestones that get me every time. Cobbler refreshes both heel tips for a mere $15. Small price to pay to preserve last faint hope I once had of motherhood.
Catherine, thank you so much for that poem. And there's so much to talk about in this. I do want to begin just with a blurb that Isabella Wang provided for your chapbook. She writes, in Zipless, Catherine Lewis invites us to stride many miles in a pair of Valentino heels, which are in this poem that you read for us. And thinking about their presence, it's so striking just how intense an image it is, not only visually when we think of these red Valentino shoes, and then distance and this idea of walking. The movement with these in this intense bit of fashion, but so much more kind of underfoot, so to speak. And in the beginning of the poem, you talk about 2,000 miles from home, and you think of covering a great deal of ground. And then in the poem, the speaker takes us kind of through this evening on these heels. I was wondering if you could tell us about just how visuals work for you and how fashion kind of works for you and how you write it and how you find, how do you allow it to accumulate so much meaning? What's your writing process with these objects?
Let's see. When I wrote this poem, this was one of the things I submitted in early February, the year of my class at the Writer Studio, and it was coming up on Valentine's Day, and my phone will remind me, yes, a year ago or 2 years ago, exactly how many years ago this happened in February, and I would see these shoes turn up in my phone's photos every year. This is an autobiographical poem, and in terms of imagery, so I would always be reminded of them every February. It was the first year I'd chosen to write about them. And when, with respect to imagery, the most important thing I've learned from my poetry mentors is be really concrete and be really specific. So I would look at the photos, I would look at the shoes, I would name off everything I saw. It wasn't me describing some clouds up in the sky. It's just me looking in my own shoe rack or down at my own feet and being very specific with building a physical world in the reader's head. That is one of the things that folks have mentioned to me when listening to my work, that it's very physical imagery. And I chose to run with this for specificity reasons.
Nice, thank you. You mentioned the Writer's Studio. I think of Betsy Warland, who started the Writer's Studio some years back, and how she is so focused on process, the process of, you know, gathering kind of your materials and then sitting down and kind of waiting for the writing to come to you, and then the editing stage. I was wondering if you could talk to us about the stages of writing for you. What stages of writing do you tend to take your work through? And what stage of the writing process do you find the most arduous or the most joyous or anything in response to the writing process?
The writing process has always been an intriguing question to me. Recently, I saw a meme that said, I know writer's block isn't real because when deadlines are there with law of money attached, I always manage to churn it out. And this is exactly how things were during my year at the Writer's Studio. This poem was churned out because I had a workshop submission due. At a certain time, I looked and said, I have to come up with something. Mm-hmm. So essentially, the imagery has been percolating in my, say, photo on my phone for years, but it took an assignment deadline for this to turn into a poem. And then there's the stages of refinement, which I've learned from various mentors, of going through all the imagery, seeing whether the imagery can be enhanced, seeing whether there's things that require repetition, seeing whether there's things that can be cut. Frequently, the first and last stanzas can just be demolished as just scaffolding. Is there anything to bring out? Is there something that is in need of further enhancement, or are you taking too long to write into what the poem is really about? So it seems like there's so many stages after the initial draft, because the first surprising thing I learned in my very first poetry class was a poem is never done. And my instructor, Fiona Tin Wei Lam, this was a SFU continuing studies, was describing how she would continue to edit her poems while reading them out loud from her published books. And I thought, oh no. And I'd be very amused to know a poem is never done. So I'm sure that I flipped through my chapbook and thought, oh, oops, that line doesn't look very good. See this instead.
Oh yeah. I think Talu Olorentova, there's an interview with him and it's titled A Poem Is Never Done. Yeah, oh my God. I have one last question in my first volley of questions, which is just about the title of the chapbook itself. You mentioned briefly before the show that it references Erica Jong and Zipless. Well, could you tell us about the title and its reference and what that means to you?
Sure. The title of the chapbook, Zipless, this is a title of a poem in the later half of the chapbook that is about a sexual encounter. And it does call back to Erica Jong's book, Fear of Flying, and the term she coined is Zipless Fuck.
I have to read. I'm not familiar with that book, so I have to read that book. I think it seems pretty foundational and important, I think, in many ways. I just quickly Googled it, Fear of Flying, and, yeah, thank you for bringing that book to our attention.
And is Zipless kind of in reference, is it that in reference to a dress, like a zipless dress, or, and then going into the sexual encounter?
I believe the term was meant to refer to a sexual encounter where clothes fall off as if without zipper.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. That totally makes sense. But I wanted to quickly jump back to the idea of the process, because I love process, even when it's arduous. And I'm curious if you're wary. And then, you know, there's satisfaction when the poem's finished, but there's always that nagging thing. Well, is it really finished? Is it really finished? Where do you sit on the spectrum of enjoyment from process to finished poem? What do you like best around that spectrum?
Things I appreciate during the various stages of a poem's existence, hearing what people think about, say, in a workshop, at a reading, and open mic, etc. There's a part of me that says, how do I know when this poem is done? Mm. And part of me realizes, I think I really need to hear from my peers to see if they have anything further to say. I know that's definitely been one of the big purposes of writing classes and workshops, so that we're not just spinning our wheels in isolation when someone else, a colleague, a mentor, a classmate will say, hey, I would love to hear you riff more on this one. I don't believe poets were meant to work in isolation.
Yeah. And I know that the pandemic has certainly limited this type of immediate feedback of going to an open mic and testing out a poem, but how much in the past, or maybe now, because you recently did a reading for the second printing of this, of your chapbook, how much of reading the poems out loud before they're collected in a chapbook or a book affect your rewriting process, if at all?
Let's see. In fact, during my rewriting process, before anything gets sent off anywhere, say, to any kind of journals or publisher submissions queue, I do a fair amount of reading out loud to myself. If I read it out loud and I trip over a line repeatedly, realize I can't even pronounce this word, I have no idea how I'm going to read this line at a live reading and have it go well, it obviously is up for a rewrite. That's why some of my classmates have said that the language in my work is simple, in that people tend not to use a dictionary to deal with my work, and that's one of the things that I've continued to do, always read my work aloud. I've always known that ultimately the big deliverable is I'm going to have to read this poem in front of people today, whether it's over Zoom, over a conference call, in person.
Yeah. And also just one last question back to that first poem you shared with us. So red shoes have been a symbol through, you know, history, through storytelling and other poetry. How much of that historical red shoe imagery were you drawing on for yourself in your own poem? Or were you trying to push against it or use it? Or how was that working for you?
Let's see. For me, I felt I was on my own path in terms of not really drawing from the external influences. I looked down at my feet, and I looked and said, one of the things that's most important is that I casually mentioned a very expensive brand name that cost me quite a bit of money, and ultimately, this buying of a designer good is an attempt at substituting, a substitute attempt, a surrogate attempt at achieving happiness through such a difficult period.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
Does money really make you happy?
Yeah, of course it does. I was thinking that if along those lines the other day, I was like, well, if you are allowed to take something with you when you die, what would be the thing that you would take with you?
Oh, wow. This question would require a lot more thought than I think there's time for. It really depends where we're going and what I'm going to need.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
this
true.
This may be one of my proudest accomplishments so far as a new writer.
All right. Well, if you're just tuning in today, thank you for listening. This is a Wax Poetic on Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM. I'm R.C. Weslowski, along with Kevin Spence, and our guest today is Catherine Lewis, a graduate of the SFU Writer Studio. And, Catherine, let's get you to share another poem from your chapbook, which is almost out of its second printing. It's called Zipless. Let's take another. Let's get another poem from the chapbook.
Thank you. My next poem for you is named Terminological Quibble. So you've had girlfriends then, she asked, Spanish red wine in hand. I don't think that's the word I would use, I reply. My bare calves tucked under short skirts, politely sipping the same red on her roommate's cream brocade couch. I've had law first dates, nothing that ever reached the level of a girlfriend. She claims me the rest of the night, with experienced lips and hands, pouting as I leave for cubicle next morning. I'm too ashamed to admit no other woman has tried to kiss me. Online dating's dream of micro-rejections filters you out before after pour over coffee. I swipe my card for us both before a waitress's card machine crosses the table. What did you just pay for me? She exclaims. Thank you so much. I'll get it next time. And I'm surprised that there really is a next date, that when we're out, we plan to meet again. Like you, I'm up for anything, I say. She corrects me. I'm not up for anything. I'm up for love. I remain with a kiss. This is the only time we speak of love in any tense but her past. Not once does talk spring from our lips about whether she's my girlfriend. At support group for late-blooming sapphics, I try out the term girlfriend, cringe and giggle when I hear it falter off my lips. I don't know what to call her when people ask how things are going with this girl I'm seeing, who asked me to come visit her back east during our farewell kiss at Denman and Davy. Last weekend at dance studio's party, I spy a pair of ladies kissing. Still have no outside queer women's spaces. I make conversation with a girl I don't know. Are you with our studio too? I ask. Oh, no, I'm dating Tara. Yes, of course. Have you tried our dance classes yet? No, I just moved here from back east. That's where my ex-girlfriend moved back to, I tell her. Only time I've let this phrase slip past my lips. Ex-girlfriend, the verbal marker that separates me from straight girls who use girlfriend for platonic BFFs, an accidental verbal affront to women who fuck when our romantic relationships are mistaken for just friends? How to casually mention your unexpected orientation. According to Google, just say, my ex-girlfriend, shorthand that I'm one of us. Each day of silence stretches us from being long distance, me secretly looking up airfare, to her being my ex-girlfriend who moved away and never got in touch again.
Thanks so much, Catherine. What a fantastic poem. Terminological Quibble. And what I love about this poem is that there's the question of what language does one use in any situation? There's that fantastic exchange, I'm up for anything, I'm not up for anything, I'm up for love. There's a kind of quibbling over the language she used. And then, of course, you explain in the poem, girlfriend, and what that means, and what that signifies for, quote, late-blooming sapphic. There's so much in this poem. Mm-hmm. There's one specificity that I wanted to highlight, which I loved and appreciated so much, the Denman and Daisy kiss, which is so fantastic that it's located in the West End, this traditionally kind of queer neighborhood. And it's at that intersection that overlooks English Bay. And so it's romantic and historic, and it's so fabulous. I'm at a loss for words. I don't know. I don't know what to say. Can I ask where that poem began, if it began with an image or a line?
In this poem, this was also stream of consciousness. In case I haven't said, most of my poems are stream of consciousness. but the fact is, this one does certainly begin with dialogue and this image of these two women sitting on a couch on a date early in a queer relationship. So that certainly was imagery I chose to run with. And dialogue is very important within my poems, I feel.
Yeah, and this one especially, that terminological quibble. So the quibbling is kind of between two people, but then there's also, you hear the voice of the poet considering terminology, what language to use. And I guess that does lead me to a question. Have you arrived at a place where you're comfortable with any particular terms or terminologies?
In terms of life as a late blooming sapphic, there's been a lot to learn personally. Learning, oh yes, this is a term that girlfriend is a term that queer women tend to use only to refer to a romantic or sexual partner, whereas straight women use it completely differently for platonic friends. That was a learning curve along the way as a late blooming sapphic. And there certainly has been a lot of new terminology to learn as a late blooming sapphic. It's basically a lot of catching up.
And listening to this type of poem where you're putting conversation and dialogue inside of it, you're sort of both a participant in it and an observer of it as the writer. Are you conscious, or how conscious are you of transitioning between those perspectives as you're putting this down? Or do you just let it go with the stream of consciousness and come back and kind of figure that stuff out later?
I must admit, this is all stream of consciousness for me, and it's also much easier when you see a format on the page. The fact is, I have different indentation to indicate different speakers. That's something that doesn't show as well during a audio-only reading.
Mm-hmm. I guess the question I'm kind of curious about, as the writer, and you're involved with it, how aware, if this is an autobiographical piece, how aware are you, as you're writing it, that you are a character in it as well as the writer of it? And where does that change for you as you're creating it?
There is the notion in writing any work that is reflective of lived experiences of having to think of yourself as a character, having to try and see yourself as the world may see you as well, as opposed there's various levels of presenting a protagonist to the world. You've got the levels of what she thinks, feels, how she observes the world, and then looking and seeing, how does this look as a scene in a movie? If you were to say to describe it from a playwright sense or a film director sense. So all those do come into play when I'm being descriptive.
Yeah. And also, how important is being truthful as compared to being honest when doing this sort of basing stuff on a, true story sort of thing for you? Which part of the teeter-totter do you reside?
To me, they feel like the same question.
Hmm.
Uh, I, I've heard people talk about, is it more important for you to be kind or truthful? And for me, I will always be truthful. And to me, truth and honesty are very tethered together.
Okay. So the chapbook is entitled Zipless. Let's hear one more poem from it. But first, Catherine, tell us where people can pick up a copy.
Let's see. Thank you so much. So the chapbook is available through my publisher, 845 Press. They're based out of London, Ontario. You can find links to them at my website, which is www.catherinewriter.com.
Okay, and so let's get one more quick poem out of you then, if you don't mind.
Last one for you is named Holiday Drink. Starbucks app. Too tired to pick a new drink today. I hit the reorder screen. Juniper latte displays. Alongside warning triangle in red. With bold red text. Out of season. Though I bought just last week, nearly a month past Groundhog Day, paper cup still on my cubicle desk. It's the only Starbucks drink I've had with you. That timeless girl's crawled out of your warm twin bed on Boxing Day morning to walk the dog, and Max already had one accident last week when you slept in. Full makeup still on from night before. I never dare let you see my face bare. I stood outside Starbucks. Held the leash, felt like family. Skulked away after Max peed on Starbucks metal table legs. I can't even be trusted for a minute. He emerged with a juniper latte I requested. Did not make fun of my silly drink that must offend your European sensibilities. As we inhaled our chocolate croissant and stuck in your warm bed. That was the last time I woke up with you. I hadn't realized we were just a Christmas romance. That we would now be out of season.
Oh, I get for this one and the one before, I love how the details draw us into such, in a way, intimate knowledge of the other person as well as yourself. And it feels so warm and cozy. And then there's this drop off of an ending that's heartbreaking. And I love the way you navigate that. I think that's just... I just wanted to compliment that because we don't have a lot of time for questions, but wonderfully done, wonderfully done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, such a pleasure to hear you read again, Catherine. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for all your kind words. I'm so grateful to you both for having me on your show. I've been so honored to be here for the first time.
It's great for me to meet you via this show as well, because primarily we're just friends on Twitter and that sort of stuff. So it's nice to have a conversation and chat with you and get to know you a little bit better. Really do appreciate you being on the show today. Our guest has been Catherine Lewis. Look for the chapbook Zipless. Look for Catherine Lewis online at their website and on various social media handles as well. I'm R.C. Weslowski. This has been Wax Poetic on Co-op Radio, along with my co-host,
Kevin Spence.
And No Apologies Necessary is coming up next.
broadcast from the corner of Hastings and Columbia in the downtown east side, a broadcast tower off Mount Seymour on the unceded Coast Salish territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations, broadcasting across the Salish Sea and